This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Simon Phipps and I talk with Hart Montgomery of the Hyperledger Foundation, which is part of the Linux Foundation, about distributed data and decentralized trust. But we go much farther than that into wallets, into what the real role of the Hyperledger Foundation is, how it's changed over the years, what all their different projects are, because there are many. It involves self-sovereign identity, lots of other topics, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 704, recorded Wednesday, October 26th, 2022. Distributed data, decentralized trust.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Hey there, everybody. I'm Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. And this week, I am joined by Simon Phipps himself, coming in as he will on screen for those graced with visuals. There he is.
There I am.
Lair, his lair.
I'm down here in the bunker in Southampton.
In the bunker. I'm in my bunker. I'm in a basement here for the next several months, off and on. I'll be in Hawaii one time.
Witness protection is this?
that would be cool in a certain way. One of my sons is working at a place where his coworkers who know he's very smart but don't know why he's working there asked him if he was in witness protection. So I don't know. I'm here. This is Bloomington, Indiana, and we just got a house. So by the end of the year, we'll be over there. Yeah, and my wife is over there fixing things up. Just came in and said, do you know the tiles in the bathroom are plastic and not real? I thought, no, I didn't know that. But stuff like that.
Well, you know what you need in that new house is a lovely, fresh blockchain.
It may turn out to be a kind of a ball and a block at the end of a chain. I don't know. It was built in 1900, which is rather young by your standards in the UK, but quite old here. So it's a cool house, nice, charming old house. So our guest today is Hart Montgomery of the Hyperledger Foundation and crypto and blockchain expert. You're not a blockchain fan. That's not why I invited you to co-host, but I'm gathering that.
When I first saw it, I thought it was really cool. And as time has gone on, it has looked more and more to me like slideware from a technology evangelist at a big corporation. And all the applications I've seen for it appear to be the almost criminal, if not actually criminal. And so I'm still looking for an example of some reason why it needs to exist that isn't about letting big corporate evangelists have conferences in exotic locations. So I think that's going to be my the big question that I've got to ask today. So is there any reason for this to exist?
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Okay. So I'm sure Hart is all ready for those questions. Brian warned him.
Well, let's bring him in first. I did a little bio here. Hart's the CTO of, get through that middle letter right, of the Hyperledger Foundation. Extensive experience in blockchain and cryptography. Previously worked in blockchain and cryptography research at Fujitsu Research, where he helped lead Fujitsu's efforts to develop and deploy Hyperledger tech. Prior to that, he got his PhD in cryptography at Stanford under Dan Bona. I hope I pronounced that right, where he was a Stanford graduate fellow. And he's had numerous academic publications and patents in cryptography and blockchain and brings a wealth of experience and the rest of that. And hi, Hart. Well, welcome to the show.
Hey. Thanks.
Maybe
for
we can start
me.
Out by just having you address Simon's concerns, because there they are.
Absolutely. So Simon, I like to take a pretty abstract view of blockchain. So, you know, when you ask people like what blockchain is or how do you define a blockchain, you get a lot of different answers. But I like to think of a blockchain as a distributed database with decentralized trust. And if you think about, you know, sort of what most blockchain implementations do today, you know, that's really just what they are, right? They're distributed databases with decentralized trust. And if you think about cryptocurrencies, you know, even which I gather you're not a fan of, you know, sort of like what is Bitcoin, right? Well, it's a distributed database with decentralized trust for money, right? If you think about something like Ethereum, it's a distributed database with decentralized trust for essentially computer programs, right? I mean, they we call them smart contracts, but they're essentially just Turing complete programs. And you know, trust is a continuum, right? It's sort of not all or nothing. You know, at one end you have traditional centralized databases, right? And the other you have systems that are completely, and at least in theory, if not in practice, decentralized. And you can have some stuff in the middle, right? Like if you run a Hyperledger Fabric network with crash fault tolerant consensus, you're sort of somewhere in the middle of in terms of trust. Does that sort of make sense as a as an abstract primitive anyway?
I mean, it does. You know, it's so blockchain is a distributed linked list, as far as I'm concerned, and then it's got layered over the smeared over the top of it some kind of a trust mechanism to allow people to establish links in the linked list, and some kind of voting mechanism in some applications to make sure people can handle clashes between the independent actions of the actors involved. The challenge I have with it is I've yet to see a compelling reason to use this instead of, say, a tuple space. I've yet to see an application that hasn't had to be fixed by having centralized authentication rather than distributed identity. And I've seen quite a few cases where the primary application appears to not be terribly sound. It seems to be like Bitcoin, for example, which ultimately has caused, I would argue, more problems than it's ever solved. So the challenge is less with the abstract concept, which, you know, I grok and could be called other things other than blockchain. It's that phrase blockchain has attracted to it all of the less reputable part of the internet, and they're all having a party there. And I think that's really the problem.
Yeah, I mean, so I can get into some applications if you like. So some of the cool stuff we've seen, you know, is obviously not related to cryptocurrency or token speculation or anything like that. One of the first production networks we saw in Hyperledger was called Everledger. Are you familiar with Everledger at all? This was several years ago.
I've not seen Everledger, no.
So the idea behind Everledger was diamond tracking and tracing. So if you want to buy a diamond, you presumably do not want to buy a blood diamond, right? And so the idea was, using this Everledger chain, you could see the entire provenance of diamond from sort of mine to, you know, to end user, which is, I guess, however you're wearing the diamond and jewelry. You could see this in a transparent way. And it would allow users to be convinced that they were not buying blood diamonds. And so your natural question when you're talking about, you know, any application where people are using blockchain should be, why do I need decentralization here? You know, why is there not, you know, some central authority that can just manage everything? And in this case, right, there are lots of industry players that are competitors, right? And you know, they don't trust other people to be the root of information to sort of maintain everything. If there were one central authority that had vision into, you know, everyone else's activities and control the source of information, that wouldn't be acceptable to the other players in the industry. So that was why sort of a blockchain was, you know, ideal for this case, was the decentralization in the industry and the transparency that the end users wanted.
Right.
So, you know, that I hope that at least.
So I'm looking at Everledger on screen here. So, I mean, I wrote an app that sounds a lot like that when I was at IBM in the 90s. But back before the idea of blockchain had been coined, we created a distributed ledger, and we conceived one then in the 2000s for doing transportation ticketing and for doing settlement of transportation ticketing between different transport carriers. So I've seen applications that use a distributed linked list and a distributed immutable linked list before. The thing that, looking at Everledger, the real question here is the degree to which the trust is independent of the application. And the big problem that cryptocurrencies have created for us is they've created a world where nobody is in control. And so what gradually happens is people do actually take control by taking ever larger stakes in the network and by taking ever more central convenience positions in the enablement of the platform. And it ends up being centralized but unregulated. And so the problem that there's been with much of the blockchain that I've seen has been exactly that problem. It has become centralized while without also becoming regulated. And so that's kind of the place I'm kind of needling into. I can see why I want to use a distributed ledger, because I've used one myself commercially in two previous decades. What I can't see is why I want to create a system where there is no trust authority. Why would I want to do that? Why would I not want to have a consensus trust authority, for example, as my preference?
So you're asking basically the motivating case for why should we use a fully public blockchain that's ostensibly fully decentralized. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. And I've yet to see one, honestly, that isn't in the control of some entity covertly. Be that like with a lot of crypto, where it's ultimately the control of crypto miners over in the Central Asia, or where it's covertly under the control of the technology creators, who are the only people who truly understand, even though the code is open source, how the technology works, and so they own the brand name and they tend to centralize the control of the technology. That's what I've seen all along. I really haven't seen any really big public examples of something that wants to own up to being blockchain. And maybe it is blockchain under the covers and people don't want to call it that because it's disreputable. But I have yet to see a really great example of a blockchain that will make me think, oh, then maybe this isn't the dark end of the internet.
So I guess then, so we use sort of blockchain colloquially to define, you know, public and permission blockchains, right? So, you know, informally, like, you know, we sort of use blockchain and distributed ledger interchangeably, you know, and obviously a lot of our Hyperledger code is focused on, you know, permission blockchains, like Fabric is a permission blockchain, you know, but we do have, you know, Hyperledger Besu, which is used for both public, it's a public Ethereum execution client, and it's also used for some permission blockchains. So, you know, as far as public blockchain centralization goes, you know, there is a big issue there, right? You know, obviously you mentioned miners. Now you have staking pools. I don't know if you're familiar with the staking pool stuff. So like Lido has a huge percent of Ethereum stake locked up on it. And you know, everyone's a little worried about this. There's also this issue of MEV and block creation now, if you're familiar with that as well, which is another potential censorship and centralization issue. I don't know if you've dug into that at all.
I mean, I dug into some of those. I interviewed Brian Behlendorf on Floss Weekly previously, twice actually, about Hyperledger. Brian persuaded me in his typical charming and intelligent way that Hyperledger is about taking all the good parts while not doing any of the bad parts of blockchain. you know, is that true? Is Hyperledger actually just an arms dealer to the bad guys?
Well, I think so, but I mean, Hyperledger is totally open source, right? So we're a Linux Foundation project, you know, and I define Hyperledger has changed since the days of Brian. So I define it as sort of the Linux Foundation's umbrella project for blockchain. But we are open source, and so anyone can download the code and you know, use it for whatever they want. And we have seen some use cases and some uses by some actors that, you know, in the vacuum, we would prefer not to have. But, you know, it's open source. That's just how things work. You know.
So pregnant pause there. I think, Doc, you're ready with a different thought here.
Yeah, so, you know, my, besides Brian, who's just an old friend, my main acquaintance with Hyperledger is, and maybe you could go into a little bit of where and how the Linux Foundation comes up with these foundations, so foundations within foundations. We've actually had quite a few people on from the Linux Foundation in various ways. When it started, my familiarity with it had to do with self-sovereign identity and the whole self-sovereign identity development movement, and a lot of which is based on blockchains, but some of it wasn't. Most of them did try to say distributed ledger rather than blockchain. And then when a code base was developed, it was adopted by Hyperledger, rebranded, so it was open source and under their aegis, sort of. In particular, for example, Hyperledger Indy, that was one that came from the Sovereign Foundation, where, full disclosure, my wife was on the board at that time. And I'm wondering what's changed since then. I mean, and because I know IBM was heavily involved and it had a thing going on. I don't think IBM is still there anymore, but I'm not really sure.
IBM is still there.
So what does it look like now? I don't even know what happened to Hyperledger Indy. Is it still there? Is it still doing stuff?
I'll go into all of this. So, you know, in the beginning, Hyperledger Fabric was the first code base contributed. It was contributed by IBM and Digital Asset. And it still today is what most people associate with Hyperledger, even though sort of Hyperledger has grown much larger. Since then, you know, we've had a lot more code bases contributed or sort of natively built up in Hyperledger. I believe we're at 14 projects today. We just took a new project related to Indy, which I'll talk about in a second. But, you know, we have things like Hyperledger Besu, which, you know, is an Ethereum execution client that you can run either, you know, on the Ethereum mainnet, or you can run a permissions network, so a distributed ledger, as you all are calling it, on Besu. And we actually have, there's a group called LackChain and that, you know, runs a huge permissioned Besu ledger in South America, which I think is really cool. As far as the identity side, you know, it's been really interesting to watch, and that space has grown, you know, tremendously over the past years. It started with Hyperledger Indy. Then Indy has, at this point, forked out multiple projects. So there's Hyperledger Ares, which I don't know if you're familiar with, which is sort of the agent layer of identity. There's Hyperledger Ursa, which is the crypto library. And then there's also recently an anonymous credential project was approved for... this was actually last week, so it's not up on the website yet. But this was approved for anonymous credentials and specifications. So the identity community is still going really strong. I think it's a really cool space. It's incredibly decentralized. There are tons of people from all over the world that work on it. One of my favorite facts about the identity community at Hyperledger is we have government employees that are full-time maintainers on our identity projects, which I think is really uncommon and really cool. Those are some of our most productive maintainers. The identity community... So back to sort of your thing about ledgers. So in the very beginning, Indy was an identity-focused ledger, and the idea was that, you know, you have to... root your credentials somewhere, right? You have to have a starting point for your self-sovereign identity, right? And that, you know, sort of the root of trust was going to be this distributed ledger. And this was the reason for like the Sovereign Foundation and everything, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But now, you know, everyone has sort of recognized that, you know, we should be able to root credentials anywhere. We should, you know, put them wherever you want. You can put them on different ledgers. You can put them on other trusted things besides ledgers. And you know, so we've seen a real modularization, and this is this recent anonymous credential project that came about, so that, you know, you can put your anonymous credentials on anything you want and root them anywhere. So I'm really excited by that.
Mm. I'm just looking at all the names of those projects that are up there, Hart. Do you have a concept map that shows what all of those projects do? Because they've all got, you know, the trademark safe names rather than descriptive names. And I wonder if you've got an architecture that shows how those all fit in somewhere.
So usually on the website we have them into sort of three categories, distributed ledgers, but unfortunately I don't think we have a proper DAG, a graph basically showing all of the connections and interdependencies. It's a great question. I can go through some of them if you want. Some of the complications in this are projects like Hyperledger Cactus or Cacti, which is our integration project. So, you know, a lot of people have applications where they want to connect sort of one blockchain or one distributed ledger to another, right? And this is sort of the root of this is something that's been called the blockchain trilemma. If you're familiar with this, have you all heard this?
Carry on.
No, okay. I haven't actually. So, that's an interesting. So,
Even if we have all those other people out there, haven't. So.
Gotcha. Well, so the basic idea behind the blockchain trilemma, and I believe it was first coined by Vitalik Buterin, but I'm not entirely sure, was basically that it's impossible to have in a single distributed ledger security, scalability, and decentralization. You have to sort of give up on at least one of these. Now, we certainly hope people don't give up on security, because that would be a disaster. So what this becomes is a trade-off between decentralization and scalability. So sort of the more decentralized you are, the worse you scale, right? And, you know, the more centralized you are, potentially the faster you can be, you know, the lower latency, more transactions per second, so forth, right? And you see this, right? A lot of the public blockchains have very, very slow transaction speeds, right? I mean, how many transactions can you get in Bitcoin, right? Something like 10 a second. It's not very fast. So the sort of point in this is that, you know, we don't believe that there's going to be any single distributed ledger or even database that fits everyone's applications, right? You know, you might need to be more decentralized. You might need extra features like zero knowledge proofs or other privacy preserving properties. So we're going to have a lot of, you know, today we have a lot of databases, you know, that even need to talk to each other. But we can imagine a world where we have a lot of ledgers that need to talk to each other and communicate, you know, swap assets, do atomic swaps, all this stuff. And how do we do this, right? This is pretty tricky these days. And this is one of the problems that this Cactus project aims to solve, and it works with essentially all of our distributed ledgers on this. This is the same with Hyperledger Firefly, which sort of takes a little bit different angle on interoperability and integration, where it's sort of, I almost want to call it a container for blockchain or distributed ledgers, where you sort of write code once and you can run it on a bunch of different platforms. So I guess in summary, I'll go back to your original question and pop the stack back up to that and say that, you know, it's complicated saying what projects work with what other project.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I was just looking at the whole panoply there. And as I say, it's all the trademark safe names. And I've no idea. The only way I can find out what they are is by clicking through and reading all about them. The video people can see the picture on the screen there now. that's also been a little bit of my experience of blockchain, is that people are wildly enthusiastic about individual technologies. I always had the impression at the beginning of Hyperledger Foundation that all of your initial stakeholders all contributed incompatible blockchain toolkits from their labs into Hyperledger, and your early years were spent triaging the complete differences between all of those stacks. And this looks even more so now. This looks like you've got, you know, you've got nine projects that look like they're probably ledgers, and you've got like
six. We have four ledgers
that look like they're add-ons. Okay,
we have another view that I believe is called the greenhouse view, that lets you see this a little better. Well, I guess it depends on, I guess we'll say five ledgers if we're counting Indie. But Indie is a very specialized ledger. It's, you wouldn't want to use it for a non-identity purpose. We have Fabric, which you know, or probably know. We have Besu, which is Ethereum execution client. We have Sawtooth, which was contributed by Intel. We have Aroha, which was contributed by Soramitsu and sort of has a mobile application focus. And we have Indie. So those are the ledgers. We haven't had any new ledgers joined in quite some time. So that has been, you know, we've sort of had efforts coalesce around the existing ledgers, which you know, I think has been good. I don't know. There's clearly some number of ledgers that's too much, and depending on who you are, that number can vary widely. But you know, yeah, we're excited to see the proliferation of other stuff, which are tools around making blockchain easier to run, making, you know, and I use blockchain here interchangeably with distributed ledger, and you know, making distributed ledgers easier to integrate, to operate, you know. Just streamlining processes, you know. We'd like to see stuff, you know, we're seeing more stuff on privacy-preserving tools, which is really important for distributed ledgers. And I know that's something that we haven't talked about, you know, and I guess, you know, we were talking about public blockchains. You know, one of my personal biggest concerns about public blockchains that, you know, that you didn't really get to even is about privacy, confidentiality, and anonymity. And if you want to work on those, you know, you do need really powerful tools like, you know, snarks and all kinds of zero knowledge proof stuff. And even then you have issues with traffic analysis and other stuff.
So I, boy, I've this raises a whole lot of questions, starting with privacy. But first, I have to let everybody know about Club Twit. So I'm getting our promo for that. Joining Club Twit is another great way to support the Twit Network. As a member, you get access to ad-free versions of all the shows on Twit, as well as other great benefits. There's a bonus Twit Plus feed. That includes footage and discussions that didn't make the final show edit, as well as bonus shows we've started, such as the Giz Fizz and Ask Me Anything and Fireside Chats with some of your favorite Twit guests and co-hosts. As Floss Weekly listeners, you may be interested in checking out the Untitled Linux show. That show is available only to Club Twit members. And that is a great show that Jonathan Bennett hosts, another one of my co-hosts here. And he does a great job. So join up, same thing, Club Twit for just $7 a month. Head over to twit.tv/clubtwit. And join today, and we thank you for your support, for supporting us that way. So on privacy, actually, you broke out privacy, confidentiality, and anonymity, which, you know, these are overlapping things, and anonymity is pretty well understood. Confidentiality is a matter of trust. You were talking about that at the beginning of the show. Privacy is kind of an outcome of a number of technologies. Technology is a topic kind of near and dear to my heart because I've been focusing on it for a long time. Even wrote or co-wrote a manifesto on it. That really starts with it's personal. And people need control over it. And we have privacy technologies in the physical world. Like I'm wearing clothes right now. We're all wearing clothes. Those are privacy technologies. They not only guard things we call our privates and other stuff we'd rather people not see, But also Signal, you know, you're not supposed to plant a tracking beacon on me because I'm wearing something, right? And yet online, we haven't worked out privacy yet. In fact, privacy is largely violated almost in a pro forma way. And I'm wondering if you visit that at all. I mean, what your approaches are to privacy with Hyperledger in general and with different projects in particular.
Yeah, I mean, this is a topic near and dear to my heart as well. And, you know, I could go on for hours on this. You know, on digital privacy, you know, as we are moving things to the web, you know, this isn't just a distributed ledger or a blockchain question. It's a more general question. But, you know, the analogs of sort of real world privacy are scary, right? So, you know, the classic example of identity, obviously, is presenting your driver's license at a bar to show you're 21, right? You know, you've seen this a million times, and anyone who's touched digital identity has come across this. So in the real world, right, you know, the bartender or the bouncer, the doorman or whatever, looks at your ID, you know, scans it, makes sure okay, and gives it back to you, right? And you know, the digital analog of what's happening is this guy is photocopying your driver's license, right, and then selling it to everyone he can. You know, and this is sort of concerning. You know, the fact that, you know, as more and more of our lives go online, you know, more and more of our information goes online, and this gets tracked in ways that, you know, that people don't realize or can't control. And obviously this goes back to the core of self-sovereign identity, right? Is that, you know, you should control your identity. You should control your data. But again, the question is how, and the question is, you know, can we put this in terms that are sort of, you know, easily understanding for people, right? One of the complicating things is if you have a system, you know, like a distributed ledger or an identity system or whatever, how do you even define privacy for that system, right? Even anonymity can be tricky to define, right? You know, and lots of people, you know, use sort of what I call the Patches O'Houlihan strategy for privacy. I don't know if you've seen the movie Dodgeball, but, you know, this is basically just, you know, they just throw some cryptographic tools at the problem and just sort of hope it works. But, you know, if you really want to say a system has privacy, you need to formally say what privacy means, right? And you need to have a definition that makes sense. I hope this is making sense to you all.
Yeah. There's a... two things. One is I've loved the idea of self-sovereign identity from the start, just by the name of it, which a number of companies feel uncomfortable with. But to me, the internet as essentially a peer-to-peer system at the bottom level, basically promises everybody full agency, and if they want it, or something close to full agency. And yet, we've built lots and lots of very large companies that can do what only very large companies can do. And we need those. And then if you told me in 1995 that in 2022 we would still be using logins and passwords, I think you're crazy. And yet here we are. I mean, some things are miracles on the order of loaves and fish, and on the other, there's you know, some things never change. And I wanted to mention somebody. I just talked to somebody yesterday. This is actually, I'm not sure it's a blockchain project. It's at Tide.org. They're in Australia. And they have a way to get rid of passwords, basically, by having individuals, when they participate in a system, their password is sharded out to many different points in a distributed, not a distributed ledger, but in a distributed database. So no one part of that database, or many databases, knows the whole password, which it's an approach to getting rid of passwords that I found really interesting. And And they, it's not exactly a blockchain because it's not one ledger across which everything is replicated. It's, there are many different nodes that are doing different things. But the, what I like about it is that it attacks that problem and it starts with privacy as a need, but it's still a B2B thing. And the thing that I've wanted, I'd like to shift if we can to wallets, because wallets have interested me since Google and Apple and others brought it up like 10, 12 years ago. The wallet I have in my pocket is my wallet. It's not a Google wallet. It's not an Apple wallet. It's a place where I keep verifiable credentials. They reveal more about me than I'd like. If somebody wants to know that I'm over 18, they don't need to know where I live or what color my hair was, when I had it. And that's one of the promises of SSI is that we don't have to disclose everything. There's what Kim Cameron of Microsoft, with his 7 laws of identity called minimum disclosure for constrained use and justifiable parties and plurality of operators and individual control over consent. And I see us moving in that direction. But part of what I'm looking for from you is some assurance, maybe some detail on how, on the one hand, doing what the Linux Foundation does, I think, extremely well, which is bring a bunch of big companies and big developers and happening things together, kind of into one room or under one umbrella, and have them not so much get along, but work together on something that they all need and they're not going to compete on, and then compete on gravy, whatever the gravy is, on the one hand, and on the other hand, have the individual represented in here somewhere, so that self-sovereign entity is actually a primary actor and not a secondary one. That'll make sense as a bit of a filibuster. Sorry.
No, absolutely. Like that's, self-sovereign identity, verifiable credentials, and anonymous credentials are a huge part of this upcoming Open Wallet project. So for those of you that aren't familiar, there's a big effort going on right now at the Linux Foundation to start a new open wallet project. There's a ton of stuff online if you're interested. But giving users agency and self-sovereign identity are a big, big design principle of this wallet. And what you described earlier, which is the key sharding, that's also in scope. And while we aren't far enough to have like an architecture or a roadmap, this kind of thing, which is usually called an MPC wallet, for lack of a better word, because it usually uses MPC, which is multi-party computation, or some kind of threshold cryptography, to do this key sharding and key recovery. Those are all things that people are interested in seeing. I think people are. People will recognize the desire and the need for these things. I think the wallets of the future will have these.
So did you breathe hard there, Simon?
I did. I'm watching all this, and I saw Open Wallet when it was announced. It seems to me that we didn't listen to Simpson Garfinkel when he wrote Database Nation, what seems like yesterday to me, but actually was really quite a long time ago, where he pointed out that centralization without regulation leads to a loss of privacy. And it seems to me that Open Wallet Foundation is very likely to lead to a multiplicity of centralized wallets owned by brands facing towards consumers, rather than to a technology that will allow me as an individual to control my relationship with brands. Am I misunderstanding this, or is that really what's going on?
So I think if people build a wallet that support, like I as a company, right, can build a wallet that supports self-sovereign identity, that supports verifiable credentials, that supports anonymous credentials, that still lets you control your identity and control what you disclose, right? I think a lot of companies and a lot of people recognize the merit of a neutral wallet, right? And that if there is a neutral wallet or a neutral wallet backbone, shall we say, that, you know, people, particularly privacy conscious people, will gravitate towards that. You know, so I'm not sure I entirely see how, how an open wallet would contribute to centralization. And I think honestly, in the wallet space, at least in the digital wallet space, you know, centralization really can't get any worse. The space is already extremely centralized. You know, Apple Pay has just an enormous market share. And outside of that, the Google Wallet and the Google Pay, you know, between those two, they pretty much have the market cornered.
What I don't get here is really what's going to create that neutral wallet. Because what I am expecting Open Wallet Foundation to do is to create a toolbox, a set of parts like Hyperledger Foundation has done that other people will then build applications with. And the other people who will build those applications will undoubtedly be brands. And what we will see is a multiplicity of brands with interoperable systems to the extent that it satisfies their business needs, still being used from a point of control in facing consumers, rather than something which is going to empower me to pick and choose between all brands that I'm going to use, which is an outcome that could only come about if it was either achieved through regulation or through a very powerful centralized charity. Again, you know, what am I missing here? It looks like it's going to build a toolkit. It doesn't look like it's going to build a wallet for me to control the brands with.
It is going to build a toolkit. Regulation is already heavily in play, particularly, you know, European regulation, which is, you know, as you're aware, much stronger than U.S. regulation. And I don't think, you know, you're not going to want a different wallet for every brand, right? That's going to be massively inconvenient. That's not how it works today in either the real world or the digital world. The hope is that, you know, the market will steer us towards this sort of like, you know, neutral wallet that does enable, you know, privacy preserving consumer functionalities. That's what we expect. Does that make sense?
I'm being a British cynic rather than a hopeful American. I look at this and what I see happening is the toolkit being used by a family of brands to build interoperable wallets. But they'll want me to have their brand wallet on my phone so that I tend to shop with them, so that I tend to share credentials with them, and they'll want to use the interoperability that Open Wallet Foundation gives them in order to have favored relationships with their partners. But none of this is going to be designed so that it's in my interests. It will all be designed in the interests of the brands. And the only way you can avoid that is if Open Wallet Foundation instead builds an open wallet that all of its member companies then choose to make their systems compatible with. And if that was what you were proposing, I'd be really quite excited about it. But it sounds very much like the world I'm going to see is the first world.
So I hope not. In the open source community, you know, we can sort of only get the software out there and hope the best things happen. You know, we can't control who uses the software, you know, necessarily for what purposes. You know, a lot of the companies that I have talked to about this, you know, do want to respect privacy. They do want to do it right. You know, there are regulations that that handle, you know, particularly in Europe, a lot of the privacy issues and things around that. And, you know, not every people just don't want a multitude of wallets, right? People want to use one wallet. They want to use it seamlessly. I'm not sure that I really see this like proliferation of wallets happening. You know, I think, you know, there may be, you know, some collection of wallets, but at the end of the day, in the real world, I have one wallet, right? And I presumably want to have one digital wallet too, right? And then if brands want to participate, you know, we can you know, they can give me credentials. I can give them credentials, right? But I would hope it would be through this one wallet and not through this proliferation of wallets.
Are you going to make a reference implementation of an open wallet that maybe might be the seed for a citizen-centric rather than a brand-centric tool?
People definitely will. Yeah. I don't know that we will have, you know, an official Linux Foundation or an official open wallet, reference implementation. But, people like the government of British Columbia are involved in this project. And I highly doubt that, you know, they're going to put something together that's, it's not consumer or citizen friendly, right?
A couple of things. One is I'm glad you brought up British Columbia because that I think is one of the blockchain success stories. Anyway, that they're using blockchain in their own identity system.
Absolutely, it's live.
It's live. It's been there. It's been there for a while. I want to stay on the wallet for a minute because I want to know what it looks like and what's in it because. Is it something that is something I could click on the front page of my phone? Is it something that's just invisible and it's just basically I have a database that I just know and it just gets used and it just be it's as I go to the show, I've bought a ticket, I carry a verifiable credential. I wave my phone in front of something or there's a QR code involved or there's just a verifiable credential in a verifiable credential scenario. And that happens. But there's one question about that, which is what it looks like and feels like. So we know what we're talking about. The other is what else goes in there? Because my fantasy is I have a lot of data about myself that's not just a verifiable credential issued to me, say by my school that I went to or by the credit card company or the drivers or the, you know, the DMV or the government in some way. But I also have like all my health records, all my financial information, all my possessions, where I may wish, for example, to disclose to an insurance company what some of my possessions are. That's my Internet of Things. And I'm wondering if those kind of things are imagined as among the forms of data that pass through a wallet, that it's not just I deal only in transactions, but rather something more rich and complicated than that.
Yeah, so you asked a lot of questions there.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No worries. It's totally fine. So, you know, this is very early effort, right? So we don't know exactly what the final shape will be, right? You know, we haven't officially formed the project yet. We just have a group discussing the formation, if you will. So sort of questions about that, like what's the final shape and all that. You know, this is not yet determined. So I can't give you a great answer on that. As far as the other data goes, there's a lot of stuff that's in scope with this, right? People want to be able to do, I guess I'll call it records, if you will. Obviously things like education credentials, but this would also presumably include medical records, right? And those are particularly interesting, right? Because you know, under normal you have to be sort of careful, right? Because under normal circumstances, you should absolutely have control over those records. But if you're in, you know, an emergency room situation, you may want someone else to be able to override that, right? I think, you know, while I can't say for certain, certainly this general like nebulous area of important personal records would be in scope.
Yeah. Well, that's encouraging. Actually, I want to get into crypto a little bit before the end of the show, but, sure. Simon, I think you had one more question about the foundation itself and what it might do.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I don't know if it's a question or not, Hart. But would the Open Wallet Foundation consider being an independent 501c3 public charity rather than a trade association? Because it seems to me that many of these questions we're talking about serving the public before serving the brands comes down to having an entity that is designed to serve the public instead of serving the brands.
Well, the Open Wallet would be under the Linux Foundation, so technically it would be under a charity.
But the Linux Foundation isn't a charity, it's a trade association, it's a 501c6.
Sure. So you're asking, I think it's an interesting question, you know, if you could put together, you know, a charity to implement, a fully consumer focused, you know, privacy preserving open wallet. But I think that, you know, I think there are a lot of people that are going to work on this and do this, right? Like, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I would trust like what the government of British Columbia would put out, for instance, right? So I don't know if that will happen, but I do think there are certainly, you know, parties involved, you know, in this, you know, that would put out something that would be consumer focused.
So, and I think I once went on about something and the guy I was talking to says, well, I think you've nailed that one to the floor, Doc. And so I think we've covered the wallet question pretty well. I'd like to ask a crypto question because you're a degreed and respected authority on it. And it's a simple question, which is, can people really will people understand it? I mean, because as soon as you get into key pairs and public and private keys and PKI and how all that works, people not only tend to glaze, but people in the long run, they learn a QWERTY keyboard. They know what internal combustion is. There's some fairly complicated things that everybody can understand to some degree. People learn to drive. That's a really complicated thing to do, or to ride a bike. So can people understand crypto? Can crypto be something where there's common knowledge about how this works? Or is it always going to remain the domain of weenies like us? I don't know.
Well, absolutely. At a high level, I think it's definitely possible. And, you know, I think every, you know, software engineer should understand how it works at a high level. More importantly, what are the common primitives? What guarantees do they give? And how do things work, right? You know, for a digital signature algorithm, for instance, right? It's a tuple of three algorithms, right? You have a key generation algorithm, you have a signing algorithm, and you have a verification algorithm, right? And the idea is, you know, if you have the verification key, you can verify standard or signatures, right? If you have the signing key, you can sign. And if you have the verification key but not the signing key, you shouldn't be able to forge signatures, even if you've seen existing signatures, right? And that's the high level understanding of the primitive, but that's basically it to a digital signature, right? If I give you a digital signature API, you just need to know that. You don't need to understand, how the math works or anything like that, right? Understanding some of the math behind some of these cryptographic primitives can be quite complicated. Like pairings are mathematically challenging. Some of the newest post-quantum cryptographic primitives like elliptic curve isogenies are also quite challenging. But, you know, the good thing is you don't necessarily need to understand that to use cryptography, right? And we just hope that people can learn enough to use cryptography. It's not important for everyone to understand the math behind cryptography, but it is important for people to understand the primitives and what they mean and sort of what they give you. I hope that's clear.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Actually, did you want to ask the question you just put in the chat?
I will.
There?
So, semi-seriously, Hart, what should we call cryptography now that cryptocurrency has stolen the abbreviation crypto?
I still call it crypto. I mean, if you, you know, there people at the academic cryptography conferences still print out shirts saying that crypto means cryptography. So crypto, when you say crypto to me, it means the, you know, the big academic conference hosted in Santa Barbara annually. I still refer to cryptocurrency as cryptocurrency. So maybe I'm not the right person to ask, because I'm one of the last remaining holdouts on this, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, welcome to the Legion of the Elderly with Doc and I. This is an eternal challenge when somebody steals the word that you use to describe yourself to instead describe something that you're not very fond of. But I actually think this is a serious problem for the public understanding of science, because when you say crypto, I know that what you mean is cryptography, and I know that what you've got to say is of deep worth and highly educated. When a newspaper hears you say crypto, they're thinking Bitcoin, and bringing public understanding to science has got to be harmed by that.
We're getting toward the end of the show, and I just need to jump in on this one, which is we've had this problem with hackers for 40 years. On the one hand, it's a badge of honor for those who call themselves that. There's a big fat dictionary of terms that they use, and at the same time, it means bad guys. And I don't think we'll ever solve it, actually. I think that's a tough one. But anyway, this has been a great show, and I'm sorry that hour went very fast, even without ads in it. So are there any questions we haven't asked yet you can answer briefly before we finish, Hart?
I think you all have done a great job of asking questions. I've appreciated them.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been great having you on the show. Two more before we go. What are your favorite text editors and scripting language?
Well, for what, I guess, is the question.
Any answer is fine. It doesn't matter. You can qualify to do what you want.
Because I use very different things to write, like papers, than I do to write code. I've always been someone who uses Emacs to write code. My LaTeX editor has changed many, many times over the years, and it almost always changes as soon as I get a new computer. I think I'm using some kind of tech shop right now. And so what was the other question?
Scripting language.
Scripting language? Does Bash count?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, well, that'll be my answer.
We've had Brian Fox on here talking about that as himself, dude.
Yeah.
Who created Bash. So that's great. I appreciate it a lot. It's been great having you on the show. Love to have you back, especially to, you know, since Hyperledger's changed as much as it has in the last several years, it'll change some more. So it'd be great to hear from you again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for your time.
And thank you too. So Simon, dude, you were strong there. I didn't mean to bring you on for that reason, but you know, you always has tough ones.
Well, you know me and crypto, Doc. I mean,
I didn't that well. Now I do.
Now you do. So. Yeah, yeah. So you know, Hart has been a great interviewee. There, he's been very tolerant of some tough questions. I do think we find ourselves at a juncture where we should be asking whether a charity should be doing the work that Linux Foundation has picked for Open Wallet Foundation, because we can't rely on adequate citizen-centered regulation arriving in time. And so the antidote for that is to have an organization whose mission is to serve the general public rather than to serve its paying members. And it seems to me that there's a very much a need for a 501c3, or what I call a public charity, to be doing some of this privacy-centric work. And if it could do it under the umbrella of the Linux Foundation so that its work is respected by those Linux Foundation members, we may well be able to head off the crisis of privacy that I think will arise from having things sufficiently anonymous that governments can't apply regulation, which strikes me actually as the worst of all possible worlds, where we have a centralizable technology through aggregated power that is sufficiently cryptographically anonymous that governments can't regulate it. That sounds terrible to me. So I think that, you know, the question I would love to ask is about the C3. And I understand Hart can't answer that. But I think that's the question that's left on the table from this discussion for me.
Well, I look at this in a more evolutionary way. I think that the Linux Foundation was a... I think a brilliant move is I think there needed to be a trade association there. I don't think of them so much as a trade association, but they certainly qualify because, you know, big companies pay to belong. But there does need to be a big tent where large entities that can afford a lot of developers and are doing, you know, work on which that's responsible for a lot of what we do in the world, can gather and work on open source stuff, that they share. I think there's a hole exactly where you say, which is on the customer side, on the individual side, the consumer side. And that's why we started Customer Commons, which is a 501c3 years ago. It is completely funding free. So, and if the Linux Foundation wants to talk to us about that, that'd be great. I wouldn't mind being under that umbrella if that fits. I don't know if 501c3s fit under that. But we have another example of a case where that worked out. Not that there were any big companies involved in creating it with Creative Commons, with copyright. It's a very limited scope of what they're responsible for, but they created a way for anybody that does any kind of art to have some control over their copyright. And that has created, that changed the world in a lot of positive ways. So I do see some hope there. I think it's early. I think it's early, and I do hear Hart on the sincere efforts that are going on within Hyperledger or in the wallet thing as well. I think any developer working on a wallet is going to feel his back pocket and say, "I want to work for this," and not just for, you know, whatever large employer, you know, they might be working for at the time, and and who stays forever with any one large employer anymore either. So that's another. You know, if not a saving grace, at least a grace of some kind.
So I think there's lots to talk about still here, Doc.
You know, always is.
And again, curiously, you know, this is blockchain we're talking about, and here's me saying we need to talk about it some more.
There you go.
So we need to have maybe get a round table together where there are some different voices who can argue it out without weapons.
Well, that might be better, and you know, maybe we can assemble one here. You know. That's a possibility too, and so I just thought of something I could promote for that. But go ahead. What do you want to plug before we get off?
You know, I'm promotion free this week. I don't have anything that I want to plug. For the people on video, just follow me on Twitter and on. I'd love to see a whole load of people following me on the ActivityPub Federation. So that's Mastodon, Pleroma, Plume, all of those, where I am. Mastodon website is meshed.cloud, and I am at Webmink on meshed.cloud. I would love to have a whole load of listeners and viewers here joining me on Mastodon, and the quality of the conversation is somehow much better on ActivityPub than it is on Twitter. So come find me on there.
Yeah, okay. Well, then, and after the next couple of days, I think the 30th is when Elon Musk does or does not buy Twitter, and Twitter may... There may be a rush to your small tent there before that happens. Speaking of round tables, the Internet Identity Workshop, look it up. The short link is iiworkshop.org. Happens twice a year. The whole SSI thing that we talked about came out of that. Pretty much everything I know about what Hyperledger is doing is actually through sessions that we have. It's an unconference. It happens at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View in California in Silicon Valley. Happens twice a year. It's three full days of nothing but gatherings of people in breakouts. There are no keynotes. There are no no panels or anything like that. It's just sponsors buy food and projectors and things like that. They don't run the show. So anyway, look it up, iiworkshop.org, and come there. This is exactly the kind of thing we like to talk about there. Also coming up next week, we have Jeff Geerling on. He's at jeffgeerling.com, G-E-E-R-L-I-N-G. He was formerly with Acquia. I'm not sure exactly what he's doing right now. We'll find out a week from now. Until then, I'm Doc Searles. This has been Floss Weekly. We'll see you then.
Hey, folks, I'm Ant Pruitt. And what do you get your favorite tech geek that has everything? A Club Twit gift subscription, of course. Twit podcasts keep them informed and entertained with the most relevant tech news podcasts available. With the Club Twit subscription, they get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They also get access to our members-only Discord, access to exclusive outtakes, behind-the-scenes, and special content such as AMAs, which I just love hosting, plus exclusive shows such as Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Purchase your geek's gift at twit.tv/clubtwit, and it will thank you every day.